everyone. The month of July sees two very significant dates when two different but related revolutions are celebrated. July the 4th, of course, is Independence Day in America, while July the 14th is Bastille Day in France. By just managing to squeak in today's podcast into the tail end of July, I'd like to link these two dates mainly through an extraordinary character whose plays inspired two of the top 10 operas performed today, Pierre-Augustin Caron de Beaumarchais. I will discuss his life, his significant influence on the American War of Independence, his Figaro plays, and his influence on Mozart and the development of opera. I will also touch on some other interesting figures surrounding this period, as well as the two significant revolutions of the 18th century. With all the hullabaloo surrounding the American musical Hamilton, and how it has supposedly opened many people's eyes to the good works of one of America's founding fathers and his role in setting up the society in which we now live, it is curious to me that the support of the French during the American War of Independence is not explored more deeply in the musical than through the gentle caricature of a foppish Marquis de Lafayette. Gilbert du Motier, Marquis de Lafayette, was anything but foppish, and such a hero to the Continental Army and the U.S. military in general that at his grave, at the Picpus Cemetery in Paris, there has flown an American flag since July 4, 1917. On that day, a delegation from the U.S. Army, including General Pershing, visited the cemetery to pay their respects to le héros des deux mondes, the hero of two worlds, as Lafayette was known. They had arrived in Paris to help the French in World War I, and at Lafayette's grave, Colonel Charles E. Stanton uttered the now famous phrase, "Lafayette, nous voilà, Lafayette, we are here." Lafayette is buried there under soil from Bunker Hill. Also interred in the Picpus Cemetery are many victims of the French Revolution, including the family of Lafayette's wife, Adrienne de Noailles, and also the 16 Carmelite nuns martyred in the closing days of the Reign of Terror, who were the inspiration for Francis Poulenc's harrowing and moving opera, Les Dialogues des Carmélites, The Dialogues of the Carmelites. Another significant figure buried there is the French poet André Chénier, guillotined only 3 days before Robespierre, and familiar to many opera lovers through the Verismo opera by Umberto Giordano, which bears his name in Italian, Andrea Chénier. But returning to Lafayette, he was a French aristocrat and military officer, and an extraordinarily important figure in the American War of Independence, commanding troops in the Battle of Brandywine and Rhode Island, as well as the final siege of Yorktown. As a 19-year-old, he felt compelled to support the cause of liberty in the New World, and so he left his very young wife and family, purchased his own ship, made his way to America, and was taken under the wing of George Washington, who regarded him as a son, and still at the age of 19, Congress commissioned him a major general. In return, Lafayette led with distinction and success, and named his own son after Washington. Upon his return to France, he helped write the Declaration of the Rights of Man and of the Citizen in 1789, in consultation with Thomas Jefferson, advocated the end to slavery, was appointed the Commander-in-Chief of France's National Guard the day after storming of the Bastille, stayed towards the middle ground in the French Revolution, and refused the offer to be made French dictator after the July 1830 Revolution. From the late 18th century to mid-20th, Lafayette was lauded in America in recognition of both his significant aid during the American War of Independence, as well as his part in the development of French democracy. When he returned to the U.S. for the 50th anniversary of the country he helped to found, Lafayette visited and was feted in all the states of the Union. He has had over 100 counties and towns named after him in the U.S., as well as places like Lafayette Square in Washington, D.C., immediately north of the White House. If many in the U.S. today don't know of the incredible impact that Lafayette had on our democracy, then it is no surprise that most Americans would be unaware of the impact that Pierre-Augustin Caron de Beaumarchais had on both the American War of Independence and the French Revolution, as well as the development of theatre and opera. As an opera conductor, why am I interested in Beaumarchais? He only wrote one libretto for the opera Tarare in French, with music by Antonio Salieri, Mozart's rival in Vienna. It's not for this that he is known for in posterity, but his main contribution to the operatic art form was writing two scintillating plays that were then turned into spectacular operas, Le Barbier de Séville and especially Le Mariage de Figaro. As an opera conductor, therefore, I'm very grateful to Beaumarchais for having written these two fine plays, as well as the third in the trilogy, La Mère Coupable. But Beaumarchais' sphere of influence went far beyond being a man of letters. What was his impact, though, on the American War of Independence? Beaumarchais provided significant and crucial amounts of arms and financial assistance to the American revolutionaries on behalf of the French government through a Spanish-French shell company called Rodrigue Hortalez et Compagnie. Let me tell you a little about the person who was to become known as Beaumarchais. Pierre-Augustin Caron was born into a middle-class Parisian family in a street just off the Rue Saint-Denis, immediately south of the market district of Les Halles. His father, André-Charles Caron, was a Protestant watchmaker from near Meaux in the cheesemaking area of Brie. He converted to Catholicism upon his arrival in Paris, and the young Pierre, after some schooling which included Latin and music, worked as an apprentice for him. At the age of 21, Pierre invented an escapement mechanism for watches that allowed them to be made more compact and accurate. This invention was important enough for the patent to be stolen by the royal clockmaker Jean-André Lepaute, Pierre's mentor at the time, but Pierre successfully sued him for the patent, which led to King Louis XV to recognize his talent and to name him Purveyor to the King after he commissioned a watch mounted on a ring for his mistress Madame de Pompadour. Pierre married an older widow, who then died, leaving him only the idea for his new name, de Beaumarchais, taken from Le Bois Marchais, the name of some land owned by his deceased wife in Brittany, near the city of Rennes. Appointed to teach King Louis's daughters the harp, Beaumarchais became a regular at court and soon came to the attention of Louis himself. After helping the wealthy entrepreneur Joseph Duvernay in gaining the king's approval for building a new military academy, the now called Beaumarchais went into business with Duvernay, who then assisted him in acquiring the titles of secretary counselor to the king in 1760-61, thereby gaining access to French nobility. This was followed by the purchase in 1763 of a second title, the office of Lieutenant General of Hunting, a position which oversaw the royal parks. In 1764, Beaumarchais set off for a 10-month sojourn in Madrid to help his sister Lisette, who was abandoned there by her fiancé. This stay proved very useful to his future plays set in Spain, as well as providing him with contacts and introductions for arms-dealing enterprises for the king. However, after he returned from Spain, the death of his business partner Duvernay plunged Beaumarchais into legal problems, as Duvernay's sole legatee or heir, a grandnephew, falsely attested that Beaumarchais owed him a large sum of money. The litigations that ensued, initially from Duvernay's grandnephew, but then countered by Beaumarchais himself, catapulted Beaumarchais into public life as a sort of social justice champion. He wrote and published various pamphlets lampooning his artistic adversaries and the legal system, and these were eagerly devoured by the scandal-loving and increasingly anti-aristocratic public. Beaumarchais, although emerging victorious from these legal proceedings, was nevertheless stripped of his civil rights, and the judge who tried his last case, Goesman, was removed from the bench after it was discovered that Beaumarchais had bribed his wife. the litigations that Beaumarchais went through and the witty pamphlets he distributed throughout the processes were great experiences to be rechanneled through various passages in Le Barbier de Séville and Le Mariage de Figaro, especially the courtroom scene where Figaro is contesting Marceline's argument that as he hasn't repaid his monetary debt to her, he needs to marry her. However, the financial and reputational ruin that Beaumarchais suffered at this time made him seek a very humbling audience with Louis XV, where he offered his services in any way possible in order to restore his good name. The king, realizing Beaumarchais' intelligence, perspicacity, and resourcefulness, and relying on Beaumarchais' desperation to ensure his discretion, entrusted to him certain delicate tasks which in effect turned Beaumarchais into a royal spy. It was this new course in Beaumarchais' career which led him to take up and support the cause of the American War of Independence. In brief, Beaumarchais was dispatched first to Amsterdam and Vienna, and then to London under a pseudonym, Monsieur Ronac, an anagram, of course, of Caron. In London, he was directed to destroy a sensitive pamphlet libelling Madame du Barry, one of King Louis's mistresses. Once he had achieved this, he was then charged with persuading the French spy, the Chevalier d'Eon, to return to France together with all the sensitive political documents he had amassed pertaining to the current Franco-British relationship. The Chevalier d'Eon, by the way, was another extraordinary character, a dragoon and spy who lived the first 43 years of his life as a man, and then the last 33 as a woman, but that's another story. While Beaumarchais was in London in 1775, fighting broke out between the British troops and American rebels in the New World, and he sent back many details to the French government about the situation there, which he learnt from many sources in England. His mission was a success. The Chevalier d'Eon handed over all his documents in return for a pension, and Beaumarchais hoped that he could now return home and that his success as a spy would persuade Louis to restore him his civil rights. But Louis then rather unsportingly died. Undeterred, Beaumarchais returned to France and started to lobby the new king, Louis XVI, to send guns and money to the rebels, because he and the French Foreign Minister, Vergennes, both shrewdly understood that if Britain succeeded in suppressing the rebels, America would be forced to side with the British, and any interests the French still had in the Americas would be jeopardized. The new Louis agreed, but was unwilling to break openly with Britain, and so he sent Beaumarchais to Spain to set up a shell company, the aforementioned Rodrigo Hortales y Compagnie, which was supported by both the French and Spanish crowns, and which proceeded to supply arms, munitions, clothes, and provisions to the American rebels. 1777 was a particularly important year for this enterprise, as Burgoyne's army capitulated at Saratoga to a rebel force largely supported by the supplies Beaumarchais had sent, and he himself profited from this not only financially, but also with his reputation restored and his civil rights reinstated. The year after, in 1778, France officially entered the American War of Independence. As we can see, Beaumarchais' reasons for helping the American rebels were not to do with high-minded principles, like Lafayette's, but his astute political instincts combined with his energy and financial sense considerably helped the rebel cause maintain resistance to the British in the 2 years before France officially joined the conflict. So, what does one do after successful and successive careers as clockmaker, royal music teacher, royal spy, and arms dealer? Well, Beaumarchais decided to become a playwright. His eloquent antics both at court and in the courtroom, combined with his witty and biting satirical pamphlets, were a sound basis for writing for the theatre. His varied careers, varied love affairs, and varied stations in life gave him ample ammunition and experience to put into plays, and finally, His almost 1 year sojourn in Spain ultimately gave him the opportunity to paint theatrical portraits of many of the people in his life, in plays set in a country other than France. This country was Spain, and the plays, his Figaro trilogy. Le Barbier de Séville was actually the third play that Beaumarchais wrote, but like the first two, premiered at the Comédie Française, which was at that time housed in the Théâtre des Tuileries, in the Palais des Tuileries, which until it burnt down during the 1871 Paris Commune was the building that joined up the north and the south pavilions of the Louvre on the now open west side, just beyond the Arc du Carrousel. Curiously, Le Barbier de Séville was first conceived as an opéra comique in 1772, in the style of Rousseau. Yes, that Rousseau, the political philosopher and author who also found time to write opéra comique, like Le Devin du Village, the village soothsayer. Louis XV was so impressed by Rousseau's opéra comique that he offered him a lifelong pension, which Rousseau then refused. Getting back to Beaumarchais, though, after being turned down by the Comédie Italienne in 1772, Beaumarchais reworked Le Barbier de Séville into the play we now know. Although it was not first performed by the Comédie Française in the Théâtre des Tuileries until 1775, due to Beaumarchais' legal and political problems, the ones that I referred to earlier. Although not an opéra comique, Le Barbier did nevertheless have original music composed by Antoine-Laurent Baudron, and one of his original songs, Je suis l'un d'or, the serenade sung outside Rosine's window to coax her out onto the balcony, was used by Mozart in 1778 in a charming set of theme and variations. Let's listen to the theme and the first set of variations of this delightful piece now. I'll provide a link to the whole thing on the Concert Opera webpage. When looking at the characters of the Figaro trilogy, it's not difficult to recognize that Figaro represents Beaumarchais himself. As we saw with his pseudonym in London, Monsieur Ronac, Beaumarchais was perhaps fond of anagrams, and so we have an intriguing one of sorts with Figaro. When Beaumarchais was a young apprentice to his father, he referred to himself as Caron, fils, son of Caron, out of respect for his father, And it's no stretch to see that if you invert the two words, you make fils carron, and from there it's no great leap to Figaro. Figaro, like the mature Beaumarchais, is a jack of all trades, who lives by his wits, runs rings around everyone with his intelligence, makes his fair share of enemies, dabbles in a literary career, is occasionally imprisoned, is always looking to make money, and is happy to be part of whatever interesting and clandestine intrigue is on offer. Interestingly enough, the character of Cherubin, or Cherubino, or Little Angel, that we first find in Le Mariage de Figaro seems to be modelled on the young Pierre Caron, who was enterprising, witty, naughty, got into a lot of trouble, and had an eye for the ladies. Both the plays that were turned into operas come to life even more when one understands this quasi-biographical bent. And I do chuckle at Beaumarchais' hubris in putting himself on the stage in two stages of his life, both as Figaro and Cherubin. Other names in the trilogy have barely concealed significance, of course. There is Rosine, the little rose who is anything but pure in Le Barbier, Count Alma Viva, Count Living Soul in Spanish, a fittingly pretentious name for a vain noble, Suzanne, with her undeniably chaste biblical overtones, the pompous-sounding Don Bartolo, and the snake or basilisk-like intimations of Don Basile. Even Marceline, the pugnaciously determined spinster, has a name with a meaning, most likely derived from Mars, the god of war. So you know Marceline is a warrior woman. Lorenzo da Ponte, Mozart's librettist, added a cheeky twist to one of these names in his libretto for the Le Nozze di Figaro when he turned Fanchette, the girl who seduces Cherubin in the play, into Barbarina, the naughty opposite of what Cherubino is meant to convey. Barbarina knows exactly how she is manipulating people. But I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. The Beaumarchais names are brilliantly appropriate for the characters that he has created, and add another humorous layer of nuance that is often not referenced. The character of the judge Don Guzman Bridoison in Le Mariage, Don Curzio in Le Nozze di Figaro, is the only overt caricature of someone actually known to Beaumarchais, and was a jab at the very judge Louis Goezman who Beaumarchais had tried to bribe a few years back, and whose end of career he brought about through his series of pamphlets. Le Barbier de Séville was premiered in 1775, oddly enough, just as Beaumarchais was becoming more involved in sending arms to the American rebels, and was then turned into operas by Giovanni Paisiello, 1782, Nicolas Isouard, 1796, and quite a few others before Rossini composed his definitive version, Il Barbiere di Siviglia, in 1816, completely capturing the wit of the play, if somewhat ignoring the biting political and social satire. Although I am very fond of Rossini's Il Barbiere di Siviglia, I'm more interested in Le Mariage de Figaro and how it turned into Le Nozze di Figaro. Although the play Le Barbier de Séville was not a success on the first night, Beaumarchais was astute enough to remedy the faults so that by the third performance it was a hit. It would take 3 years for him to write the sequel, Le Mariage de Figaro, as he was rather occupied with the shell company Rodrigue Hortales et Compagnie and running arms to the American rebels, as we have seen. Whereas Le Barbier was more of a simple comic love triangle, Le Mariage was more critical of aristocratic privilege. And indeed, Figaro's famous Act 5 monologue denounces the Count and his ilk in this regard, and in heated terms, which led it to being perceived by many, including Louis XVI, as revolutionary and too dangerous to be performed. A few years later, Danton said that the play killed off the nobility, and Napoleon called it the revolution already put into action. Louis XVI was finally persuaded by Marie Antoinette to let the play be produced, and so it was performed in the newly built Théâtre Français, where the Théâtre de l'Odéon is now, in front of the Luxembourg Gardens, at the top of the Rue de l'Odéon. The site is significant in many respects, as the Rue de l'Odéon, then the Rue du Théâtre Français, was the first road completed in Paris with sidewalks. The revolutionaries Camille Desmoulins, Marat, and Georges Danton lived close by, Danton right next to the famous Café Le Procope, which was used as a meeting place for revolutionaries. Thomas Paine wrote The Rights of Man at 10 Rue de l'Odéon, just after the revolution. So, the site of the first performance of Le Mariage de Figaro is steeped in and surrounded by revolutionary history. Whether or not Le Mariage de Figaro was a catalyst for the French Revolution, or we simply look back on it as a prescient harbinger of things to come, it is certain that when Mozart read the play in German in Vienna, he was immediately struck by its operatic potential, and I believe inflamed by the anti-aristocratic and anti-clerical stances, and titillated by the type of raw and bawdy humour that he loved so much. Curiously, Mozart did not see Le Mariage in Paris when he visited there, nor did he run across Beaumarchais, although, interestingly enough, he did have dinner at Lafayette's father-in-law's house, and actually wrote some music for the Maréchal Noailles' German musicians, although Lafayette himself was still in America. This was also the time when he wrote the Je suis l'un d'or variations, as I mentioned. He had seen Paesiello's Il Barbiere di Siviglia in Vienna after 1783 sometime, and became intrigued about Beaumarchais' sequel to Le Barbier, as he was being asked to write a comic opera for the Burgtheater, or Imperial Court Theatre in Vienna. Initially, Lorenzo da Ponte, who was court librettist to Emperor Joseph II, and a decade more senior than Mozart, was not enthusiastic about Le Mariage de Figaro, because Joseph had forbidden performances of the play due to its anti-aristocratic sentiments. Mozart was determined, though, and da Ponte managed to write a libretto that was about 75% a direct translation of the play, but with such beautifully conceived new arias that reflected the human condition rather than politics. A big sticking point for Joseph was the famous Act 5 monologue of the play, where Figaro rails vehemently against the nobility. But this was replaced by an aria in Act 4 of the opera, where Figaro rails petulantly against women. Joseph was appeased by the changes, and an opera was composed that changed the nature of the art form. Why was Mozart's Le Nozze di Figaro so different and revolutionary, in the colloquial sense, common nowadays at least? Very simply, here was an opera that firmly eschewed the Metastasian concept of dramatic structure, where the plot was continuously interrupted by long da capo arias, which served primarily as vehicles to display singers, rather than to keep the audience engaged in the story and the emotional dilemmas of the characters. Beaumarchais' play, although very long, is quite fast-paced, and you must concentrate to keep up with the various plot lines. Mozart, and da Ponte I think, was really intrigued and excited by the dramatic trajectory of the play, and was determined to keep as much of it as possible, and he knew that he could hold both the dramatic and musical interest of the audience with the combination of the play's brilliance and his own musical brilliance. He didn't really know at that stage that da Ponte's success in compressing the play into a manageable form and his addition of perfectly judged arias would also help so much to propel the work to an instant success. I think it's important now to say a few words about Lorenzo da Ponte, as he is also a fascinating figure of the 18th century, whose career was not unlike Beaumarchais' in many respects. Born Emanuele Conegliano to Jewish parents just outside of Venice, he nevertheless grew up Catholic and was given the name Lorenzo da Ponte in honor of the bishop who baptized him. He and his two brothers studied for the priesthood, And after Da Ponte was ordained, he moved to Venice, where he led a rather dissolute life, had two children by a mistress, and made a living teaching Latin, Italian, and French. He was eventually banished from Venice, ended up in Vienna, and, like Beaumarchais, decided to write for the theatre, but in his case, it was composing libretti for opera. As court poet and librettist, he wrote 11 operas, 3 for Mozart, but in the end left Vienna under a cloud too, and, by way of London, arrived in America and settled in Sunbury, near State College, Pennsylvania, for a few years leading up to 1815, running a grocery store. He then moved to New York City, became the first professor of Italian at Columbia College, produced the first Mozart opera in America, Don Giovanni, in 1825, and died in the city in 1838. A huge funeral ceremony was held for him in the old St. Patrick's Cathedral. No one is quite sure where he was buried, but there is a stone marker in memory of him at Calvary Cemetery. Conducting Le Nozze di Figaro is a different experience from conducting other operas that precede it. Many operas prior to 1800, and some after that, suffer from the problem of dramatically starting too slowly. Most of the overtures to Baroque and classical operas bear absolutely no relationship to how the drama unfolds. They are there to alert the restless audience to the fact that the entertainment is about to begin. In French Baroque opera, there is generally a prologue that is sung and danced, and has characters from mythology extolling the aristocracy or playing out some unrelated scene, again to get the audience's attention before the main thrust of the plot begins. Mozart, and Gluck to be fair, tried to create overtures that either set the dramatic scene or described the emotional content of the world that we were about to enter. He did this quite well in Idomeneo, and even segued seamlessly from the end of the overture into the first accompanied recit, like he would do in Don Giovanni, and also did this well in the Entführung aus dem Serail, but it was with the overture to Le Nozze di Figaro that Mozart really achieved a perfect overture, one that was still in the expected sonata form, but that perfectly encapsulates the hustle and bustle of the Count's household on the morning of Figaro and Susanna's marriage. One of my favourite productions, by the Australian director Neil Armfield, stages the overture brilliantly. The curtain rises partway through it, and we see a bare room that the Count has gifted the happy couple, which then gets filled with both Susanna's and Figaro's stuff and household appliances by busy and slightly harried servants who all leave with the last chords as Figaro sinks triumphantly into his favourite chair, his last moment of triumph for two acts. This staging brilliantly underscores the hurly-burly of the overture, and at the same time provides a clear introduction to how we come to be in this room on this day. But what Mozart achieves next is an extended coup de théâtre. Most Baroque and classical operas, and even many comic ones, have multiple extended da capo arias in each act, between 4 and 8 minutes each. But Mozart deliberately and brilliantly chooses to have no aria or ensemble in Act One longer than 4 minutes in order to keep the drama flowing and hold the audience's attention. In fact, there is no aria in the whole of Le Nozze di Figaro that is over 4.5 minutes, if you take the right tempi, though. Thus, from the first hushed but excited measures of the overture that then explode into unbridled energy, you barely have time to breathe before Act One concludes 45 minutes later with Figaro's relentless march, Non più andrai, and then you sink into the Countess's world of sadness and listlessness for her Porgi Amor, a complete contrast from anything you have heard and experienced in Act One. The genius of what Da Ponte and Mozart achieve here in the pacing of the first act was really inspired by Beaumarchais' original dramatic flow and the drive, wit, and energy that the play already possessed. Having read the play in the original French, I understand that Da Ponte's characters are not quite as fully formed text-wise as the Beaumarchais originals, due to some of the compression of the text, but when you add Mozart's music and the characterization and profound understanding of the human condition that he brings, I believe you then have a work of art that is even greater than the original play, though very different to it. Perhaps the greatest moment that Da Ponte and Mozart created together was the aria I just mentioned that introduces the Countess at the very beginning of Act II, Borgi Amor. In the play, at the end of Act I, Basile admonishes Chérubin for spending too much time with Fanchette. "What on earth have you been teaching her?" he asks. We then change the scene into the Countess's bedroom, and she and Suzanne enter quickly. The Countess asks her maid to recap the happenings of the previous act. "Close the door, Suzanne, and tell me the whole story," she asks in a long-suffering way. Da Ponte and Mozart have provided here the most beautiful and poignant aria, Porgi amor, qualche ristoro, grant, O love, some respite from my suffering. Either give me back my darling husband, or let me die. After the humour and fast pacing of Act I, this is an incredibly moving moment of pathos, and the first time for me that time stands still in the opera. Other moments of genius in Le Nozze include the fact that there is so much musical contrast and specificity in each scene. There is not one single number that can be described as a generic operatic piece. I wish I could say the same for some of Rossini's operas. Consider the very opening of Act One. We start with a duet where we hear in the orchestra Figaro measuring the room and Susanna's delight with her hat. We continue with another duet of rustic simplicity and doorbell sound effects as Susanna explains, as if to a simple peasant, that the fact the Count is going to try and seduce her, followed by a threatening minuet where Figaro, through gritted teeth, says that he will make the Count dance, followed by a pompous caricature of a vengeance aria for Bartolo, a falsely polite duet argument between Marcellina and Susanna, which includes musical curtsies, and a breathless aria about the intoxication of love sung by an adolescent boy, etc., etc. We are only 25 minutes into the piece, and already we have experienced more subtlety, dramatic excitement, and musical interest than in most whole acts of an opera. If you would like to hear this, there are two quite good illustrations of what I'm talking about in complete recordings conducted by John Elliott Gardner and René Jacobs, both with orchestras playing on period instruments, which for me impart uniquely wonderful orchestral colors and articulations. You can see both of these on YouTube. The other glories of Le Nozze are the large 20-minute finales to Acts 2 and 4, simply the best examples of this type of complicated operatic finale in the whole of the repertoire. The wonderful thing about opera versus straight theatre is that the experience of two or more people singing together gives you a much more satisfying experience than two or more people speaking at the same time. The duets, trios, etc. in these finales are deliciously complicated, funny, and visceral, and use every musical and theatrical sleight of hand to deliver the most satisfying and euphoric experience. Most of the libretto to these finales is taken word for word from the play, which is quite incredible given the various plot lines converging, particularly in the Act 4 finale of the opera. Again, you can hear and see wonderful versions of these finales on the Gardner and Jacobs recordings on YouTube. Mozart had composed and had performed 12 other operas and singspiels before Le Nozze di Figaro, and all were hindered to a greater or lesser extent by the libretti, and in the early operas by the composer's extreme youth and lack of experience of the world. By the time he discovered Beaumarchais and Le Mariage de Figaro, Mozart had grown into a mature artist who saw the incredible potential of Beaumarchais' play and composed what I regard as the best opera of the 17th and 18th centuries, and also the first half of the 19th century, inspired to a great extent by the genius of Beaumarchais. The American War of Independence ended in 1783. Mozart's Le Nozze di Figaro was premiered in Vienna in 1786. The French Revolution started in 1789, and Mozart died in 1791. In 1792, the directors of the Paris Opera conveyed a singular honor on the deceased composer and decided to stage Le Nozze di Figaro, as well as to take advantage of the immense popularity of the play. This was an incredible gesture, as at this stage during the French Revolution, no works were being performed there by foreign composers. It was decided to put together a carefully edited version of an amalgamation of the opera and the play, with the arias and ensembles left intact, the recitatives replaced by the original portions of the play, and the revolutionary diatribes that had been so assiduously expunged by Da Ponte, they were all restored. In other words, a hard-hitting French opéra comique was created. Beaumarchais himself was eventually given the task of deciding which portions of his play were to be restored, and I find it really fitting that the Mozart Da Ponte version of the Beaumarchais play should finally have made its way back to Paris for further revision by Beaumarchais himself. What I would give to be able to see or perform this hybrid version of the play and the opera. It would be an extraordinary night in the theatre. Beaumarchais fortunately outlived the French Revolution and did not suffer the fate of the guillotine as had so many outspoken men of letters. But he survived it by only a little, as he died in 1799. He was left behind by the Revolution and became as resistant to its excesses as to the excesses of the Ancien Régime. As an opera conductor and a resident of the United States of America, I'm very grateful to Pierre-Augustin Caron de Beaumarchais and for his achievements in both theatre and affairs of state. Thank you so much for listening to this, my second podcast for Washington Concert Opera, and I hope you enjoyed learning a little more about Beaumarchais and his influences on the American War of Independence and Mozart. As I did last time, with my first podcast, I will post a page on the Washington Concert Opera website with a short bibliography and also some listening suggestions. Be safe, stay healthy, and I look forward to our next time together.